Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm going to shift gears on this show and speak with James Conlin, who is an organizational specialist with the National Education Association. And the reason I'm making the change today is that I just heard James do a presentation. I work in education, and I think everybody should know this information. It just blew me away. So, James, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So right now in Connecticut, there's an effort by the governor to, quote, reform education. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what's in Governor Malloy's reform package.
Sure. I think the components that are most troubling for educators in the state of Connecticut really come out of Section 18 of the bill, which is called the Commissioner's Network. And in the Commissioner's Network, it basically allows the Commissioner of Education to basically take over the 25 lowest performing schools. And in so doing, he can choose to run those himself, or what likely will happen is he can turn those schools over to a third party to be run.
This third party would be a private for-profit company?
It can be a nonprofit, but a private charter management company. In the state of Connecticut, Achievement First, Inc. is a charter company here that runs schools and communities in Connecticut, including Hartford. So they very well could be a recipient of some of these schools to operate. You know, that section of the bill also restricts collective bargaining for the teachers that would teach in any of those 25 schools. So that's also a critical piece for educators, is to lose their voice. And we don't believe that that's going to be a successful strategy to turn around low-performing schools. Lots of other concerns around the fact that the Commissioner of Education could also offer components of those low-performing schools with no-bid contracts. Laws pertaining to purchasing and procurement don't apply. So there's just a lot of autonomy, not a lot of checks and balances in the commissioner's network. So we're very concerned about that. Another component that we're concerned about is tying teacher certification and evaluation together based on standardized test scores. There is a committee undergoing the development of a new evaluation system that will have 22.5% of the teachers' test evaluation based on student achievement data. How that's defined yet, we don't know. But what the governor is proposing to do is to link your evaluation to your certification, which is very troubling because that can basically jeopardize a teacher's career based on an evaluation by an administrator. So, you know, we feel teachers should have more protection and so forth.
So one administrator or these test scores could say whether you have your certification or not.
Yeah, the troubling aspect is it's just not defined yet. So basically there's an agreement to use student achievement or test scores, but tying your evaluation to your certification is problematic, and that's really not something that's commonly done. Certification is usually a state function, and your evaluation is usually a local function done by your supervisor to make job decisions, whether you need additional professional development to meet expectations for career advancement. It's a local decision. And your certification is really a state function. Like a doctor or lawyer would get a license. It's done by a state agency or board. But the fact that they may get some kind of poor evaluation at their work site doesn't mean they're going to lose their license. So it's a big leap, and it's problematic.
Is there anything else in the bill worth bringing up right now?
Well, there's, you know, additional funds that go to charter schools, with local school districts would have to send additional funds. This is all the original bill that the governor put forward. And there's been a substitute bill that's been introduced, and there's still negotiations, so we're not sure what the final product will look like. But that's certainly the loss of local resources to a school district. They have to send that money to the charter schools or charter companies that will run those network schools is problematic because schools are dealing with a shortage of funds already. So that's a troubling component of the bill as well.
So you could be taking public taxpayer money from a public school and putting it into perhaps a private charter school.
Right. Yes. Well, there's some debate about what that'll be as far as profit versus nonprofit. But the fact that those schools would be able to hire consultants, no bid contracts, all those things, you know, there's just a lack of accountability of taxpayer money that we're concerned about. Mm-hmm. And we just don't feel that that's a strong strategy for turning around low-performing schools. We know that the issues are much deeper than a quick-fix silver bullet by handing it over to some third party to run the school.
And is this unique to Connecticut, these reforms that the governor is trying to put in?
They're not, no. This has been a movement that's basically been sweeping the nation for the past several years. I think most people are familiar somewhat with what happened in Wisconsin about a year and a half or so ago, because it led to mass demonstrations in Madison. And that really was around the loss of collective bargaining and some anti-union motivation. But it's kind of swept from there on around the country. So we've seen all kinds of things in states from Ohio, Indiana, Arizona, North Carolina, Idaho, you name it. It's just about everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's in the Northeast as well. So,
and who's behind this? Where is the momentum coming for this?
Well, there's multiple sources and multiple individuals and organizations behind this. One organization that's gotten some attention recently has been ALEC, and they've gotten some national attention basically due to they're advocating for a law called Stand Your Ground, which got a lot of attention in the Trayvon Martin killing in Florida. But they are deeply behind education reform bills. They have a number of model bills, which are then introduced across the country. So they bring state legislators together with corporate interests, and they draft these model bills, and they introduce them across the country.
And what does ALEC stand for?
American Legislative Exchange Council, and a conservative-leaning organization, free market, pro-business type of organization that really brings those business interests together with state legislators, and that's where they introduce these bills. So they support certain things like charters and vouchers and ed reform bills around teacher evaluations and those sorts of things. And so they've driven a lot of these bills and the anti-collective bargaining bills that you've seen in Wisconsin and then in Arizona and so forth. But there's lots of very wealthy individuals behind a lot of the ed reform movement. Bill Gates, of course, Eli Broad, who runs the Broad Academy and trains superintendents that come from the business world and then puts them into public school districts. Lots of wealthy individuals, Rupert Murdoch of Fox News, individuals behind some of the most well-known companies in the world, Walmart, Home Depot, Gap. Those wealthy individuals are involved in the education reform movement, and lots of wealthy hedge fund managers and Wall Street folks, because there's certainly a profit incentive in some of this as well. There's lots of money to be made in this high stakes testing and standards and accountability things that they push. There's money to be made there.
So we have privatized prisons, privatized healthcare, and now we're going to have, or we're moving in the direction of privatized schools in some aspects.
That's a long-term concern, I would say, definitely. And there's already a lot of profit that has been basically injected into public schools. With No Child Left Behind, roughly a decade ago or so, when George W. Bush was first elected, that certainly has led to the creation of every state in the country using some kind of high-stakes standardized tests. And there's companies that develop those, that develop the prep tests, that score the tests, and that's multi-billion dollar business for those individuals. And there's lots of companies now that are into the virtual schools or the online schools that many states are pushing. It's been big in Florida. It's now being introduced in Michigan, and it's in many places.
Tell us how that works. I had never heard of virtual schools.
Well, basically, students would complete their K-12 education online, basically. So they would log in. They would perform their... It varies from state to state and what grades they're available from state to state and how widespread it is, but basically, they can take all or some of their education online. So they'll communicate with their teachers online through chats. They'll do their assessments online. And everything is facially done through the computer. So there isn't a brick-and-mortar school. And I think some of the long-term concerns about is, what happens to the overall education of the individual child when there's no interaction and interacting with fellow students. And there's been a lot of concerns about outcomes. For example, Colorado uses virtual schools, and their graduation rate for students that go through the virtual school is 12%, while their statewide average for those that attend the brick-and-mortar school is 7-8%. There's a lot of issues of accountability around virtual schools and charter schools as well.
Now, let's go back to the collective bargaining. So around the country, then, there's an attack on collective bargaining in the school systems. And what is the research on that? Do you have any statistics on what that does to a school or to student scores?
Yeah, so there's certainly been a concerted effort to roll back collective bargaining rights for public employees. And as we know, the public sector is really the last area of workers' rights as far as unionization is concerned. We've seen unions basically decrease from roughly 30% or so in the late 70s to now maybe 10 or 11% nationwide. But in the public sector, it's many employees still have the rights to be unionized. So you've seen those things in Wisconsin. You've seen it in Indiana and Ohio and all these places to roll that back, collective bargaining rights, and really workers' rights to have a voice in their work site. If you look at it from an educational standpoint, you look at states that basically don't allow collective bargaining for their teachers, you'll see that their test scores are some of the lowest in the country. five of the lowest, six in the country are the five states that have collective bargaining as where it's illegal, basically. And so it certainly, to eliminate collective bargaining, which is one of the components of the governor's plan in the network schools, there's no evidence that that's going to make for stronger education for those failing schools. I think it'll do just the opposite. First of all, you're not going to attract teachers to go to schools where they don't have a voice in their work site and don't have the right to collectively bargain. In the long term, it just doesn't, it weakens the profession, because teachers, when they collectively bargain, they are bargaining for their students. Their working conditions impact their students' learning conditions. So they advocate and they bargain lots of things that impact their students, like class size and so forth. So it's important for teachers to have a voice in their profession, and collective bargaining is the most effective way they can do that, really.
Now, maybe you could tell us a little bit about No Child Left Behind and how it's set up so that when schools fail and then they're taken over or made charter schools, and maybe talk about Obama and his education plan, the race to the top, and if there's much difference.
Yeah, No Child Left Behind came about after George W. Bush was elected. It was basically bipartisan. It was supported by Republicans and Democrats, including Ted Kennedy in the Senate. And, you know, it has very lofty and goals that, you know, no one could disagree with, that every student will be 100% proficient by 2014, and no child will be left behind, you know, students with disabilities, students that speak another language, you know, will educate every child. Unfortunately, the strategy that went around, they used to do that, which is really high-stakes testing, kind of rewards and punishments, and really withholding funds for schools that don't do certain things, has not proved to be an effective strategy. And so some of the more well-known components of the law were all teachers would be highly qualified and all pairs would be highly qualified. But then when it came to student performance, all states had to develop some kind of standardized test. The CMT is used here in Connecticut. Every state has some version of that. And student performance based on those tests in grades 3 through 8, and it's expanded over the years, will determine whether a school is making adequate yearly progress. And each year that they don't do that, certain sanctions apply. And if they get, I think it's after year 5, then the final sanction is that the school could be closed, it could be turned into given over to a third party to run. So there's kind of an end of the line. And we're coming up on 2014, where we're supposed to meet all the goals of No Child Left Behind. And I think now with Obama in the office, they're struggling as to what that's going to look like, because I don't think there's the resources, and I just don't think it's physically impossible for them to deal with what they've deemed as failing schools, which I think is kind of a misnomer, because the vast majority of public schools are successful. And I think it's a horrible label to put on schools, on teachers and students. And so I don't think it's been effective. Obama's basically carried on very similar strategies with his race to the top. Basically, states now that are, you know, in budget crisis and school districts, they fight for this money and they have to implement certain reforms, which include reducing the cap on charter schools or using charter schools. There's components of data collection and using student achievement data or test scores in teachers and principals' evaluations. So he's in many ways kind of built on No Child Left Behind and hasn't really taken an aggressive stance to change it. He's now offering states waivers. Many states have done that. But again, in order to get the waiver, they have to do those certain ed reform things that he and his Secretary of Education, Ernie Duncan, support, which again is around evaluations and turnaround models, which usually means charter schools in many respects. So, you know, it hasn't really been a significant change, we'll say, policy-wise between the two presidents.
Is it realistic to think that by 2014 we'll have 100% student mastery?
No, I mean, where in the world is that you have 100% mastery of anything? I mean, it's an ideal goal, but it's not realistic. And an education really should be focused on educating the whole child and about human development, and shouldn't be all focused on a standardized test score, and especially when you have students in this country that don't speak English as their native language, but yet are expected to meet these same standards. We have students that have all kinds of special needs, special education students, whether it be emotional, behavioral, developmental, and everyone's supposed to be at the same standard. It's just not realistic. Now, state to state, there's been some caveats or things that have done, but overall, it's just not a realistic goal. And in turn, then, to punish schools, to withhold resources, to label teachers and students as failing. And the reality is people don't want to talk about it, or people that are proponents of this kind of ed reform movement always say that poverty is an excuse, but we really have to look at those issues in this country. We've seen tremendous, tremendous increase in income inequality. You look at the research, equal or worse than it was in the 1920s before the Great Depression. We're seeing the rich get richer. The poor get poorer. The middle class is declining. Students come to school without being fed. The only meal they get may be at the public school. So these issues of poverty, income inequality, and these bigger societal issues of what we're dealing with. And to say they can be fixed by punishing teachers or turning a school over to a private entity to run is really an easy way out. And I think politicians need to be more aggressive about dealing with the real issues in this country. And that's where it's about. So.
And in reality, poverty does seem to be one of the key issues in education.
Right.
I think you said today in your speech that there's no affluent community in the country that has failing schools.
Right. I mean, if you look at research and you know, you look at what's deemed a failing school, if you look at those schools, they are located in socioeconomically disadvantaged neighborhoods. They happen to be high minority population, African-American, Hispanic, Latino populations. You know, you go to communities where people have a middle-class lifestyle, where parents are engaged in their child's education, where kids come from a home where they have resources and they have books and they have a roof over their head and those sorts of things, those students perform very well. And if you look at some of the testing that you see that you use nationally or even internationally, and you look at poverty, American students perform very, very well with their international counterparts. When you look at successful countries, there's lots of attention being given to Finland and their great turnaround of their education system over the past several decades, and they're really championed here in this country. But there's big, big differences from an equity standpoint. Their society is about equity. There is no such thing as school choice. All schools are equitable. They get the same resources. If there are students in need, they get additional resources for those students. But they spend 16% of their GDP on social expenditures. That's education, health care, free health care, counseling, early childhood education, prenatal care, all those things. We as a country spend 4% of our GDP. And so we know we have children that are battling poverty, not a lack of health care, nutrition, and those sorts of things.
And I do think that parents of low-income households, the parents care just as much about their child's education as the affluent parents, but they're just overwhelmed with trying to make a living and make ends meet, so it's very difficult.
Absolutely. If you're struggling or battling poverty, that's a tremendous stressor on a family, on a parent. If you come from a single-parent family household, high unemployment, I mean, it can be very overwhelming. So those parents are dealing with situations that, not by choice, that they just can't be as involved in their child's education in many situations as well. They might be working two or three jobs to make ends meet. So there's lots of factors that tie into that. But a lot of countries, in Finland primarily, since that's the country that's celebrated and talked about, even by the ed reformers, they do things almost exactly opposite that we do in this country as far as respect for the education profession. And they just do things almost opposite of what you see advocated for by ed reformers and by the governor's bill. His bill does many things opposite of what Finland is doing that's raising their success.
And, you know, I work in education, and I'm not in the classroom, so I think I can say this and not be biased about it, but what I see is teachers are totally overwhelmed with all these new initiatives and things that are being asked of them to meet these testing requirements, and morale is very low, and so it's not a good situation right now. We really need to do something. What can we do about all of this? We've set up a program where 100% mastery, which can't possibly be met, and then they punish you if you don't meet it. So right from the start, the rules are set up so that we'll fail. So what can we do about all of this? And we have all these wealthy corporations and individuals trying to, quote, reform. What can we do about it?
Well, I think that's a difficult question. There isn't a quick answer or a quick fix, but I think the citizens of this country have to really step up and ask, what kind of public education system do we want? What kind of society do we want? And public education has always been the strength of this country, the foundation of our democracy. And we really have to step up, and people have to get involved and say, this is not the direction we want our education to go in. We don't want our schools to be corporate chain stores. You know, they're just open and closed based on test scores. The local community school is really the foundation of that neighborhood. And I think we have to get back to that. I think teaching has to be a respected profession. And that's what Finland has done. It is on par with doctors and lawyers. It's held in high esteem in their culture. Teachers are trusted and given the autonomy to teach students and to be creative and not have to worry about a standardized test and teach to a test. And so those are things that are really critical. And we have to allow educators to run the education system. Why people think a ex-military person or a Wall Street executive should be running an education system is beyond me. So, you know, we really have to focus back on allowing educators to run the education system and be held in higher esteem, quite frankly. So, but people have to get active. They have to talk with their legislators. They have to talk with their community members. If they attend church, people in their congregation, if they're in civic organizations, they have to talk about those things because this stuff happens pretty under the radar. People really don't understand what the real agenda is. And if you look at the commercials on TV, they're pretty nondescript. They just talk about we have to help the kids and all, but you really don't know what's going on behind the scenes and what that really means. So people just, in all respects in this country now, have to get more involved in their democracy, quite frankly.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Is there a propaganda campaign going on to make Americans think that their school systems aren't so good?
I would say so, you know, because if they're talked about in a way that they're successful, let's say even adequate, there isn't going to be the urgency for people to allow such drastic things to happen, which would be to allow one individual to take over 25 schools. Now, I don't think most people realize the amount of autonomy that's allowed there. He in this case, it's he, but the Commissioner of Education can just...
Stephan Pryor?
Correct. Can just run the school himself or basically turn it over to a third party to run with really no oversight, no bid contract, those sorts of things. So I certainly think that there is that kind of, I would say, false narrative, if that's the way you want to call it, about, you know, our schools are failing. And if you get back to the schools that we're talking about here, again, those are schools in high poverty areas that are dealing with some of the societal ills we're dealing with because we don't have funding anymore. Property taxes have gone down. The housing bubble burst. You got to look at our tax policy. You know, we have the lowest tax collection, I think, in recent years. The wealthy aren't paying their fair share as they used to. Those things affect what we're seeing nationwide as far as do our citizens have the resources to have a public education? Do they have health care? Do they have those things?
So on the one hand, the government is cutting taxes for the wealthy, which then leaves more people in poverty. The distribution of wealth becomes greater, and the 1% gets more and we get less. And then at the same time, they're putting all these high-stakes standards on us, so we have kids doing poorer because the socioeconomic level has dropped. So it's a no-win situation.
Right, and it's just quite amazing if you look at some of the various states and you look at what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin. At the same time last year that he was basically getting Act 10 passed, which took away teachers' collective bargaining rights, did all sorts of things as far as public education is concerned. At the same time he did that and still wants to maintain these high standards, he cut funding, millions of dollars from funding in public education, and then told local communities that you cannot increase your local taxes, your local property taxes, to offset those cuts. So it's like it's a strategy to make public schools fail, and then they're failing, right? So we can come in and say, well, our solution is we have to have someone else run it. Government can't run it efficiently. Government's failing. We need to put in the business model and have a corporation run this. And so yeah, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, if that's the right way you look at it. They're creating this, and in the end, they get to reap the rewards from what they view or they deem as a failing school system. Mm-hmm. And if you went to affluent communities, they wouldn't stand for this, right? Mm-hmm. And if you go to affluent communities, those community members are engaged. Mm-hmm. Many times they go to school board meetings, city council, they know what's happening in their community. In these communities where they're battling poverty, people are disenfranchised. They don't feel they're empowered to speak.
They're working two jobs.
And so this stuff can be really pulled on them, quite frankly. Yeah. It's just a really unfortunate circumstance.
I understand something like in Philadelphia, I wasn't aware. Tell us what happened in Philadelphia.
Well, it's just been announced in the last week or so that in Philadelphia, due to the devastating budget shortfalls, that they're, for all intents and purposes, dissolving the public school system. And they're going to closing 40 schools. And they'll close another 6 per year through 2017. And the remaining schools are going to package up into basically innovation zones or some term like that into groups of 25 and basically offer them off to a third-party entity to run those schools.
Essentially a corporate takeover?
Right. It could be run by for-profits or non-profits, but there's still profit within non-profits because they hire consultants. Mm-hmm. There's people that make money off of those. Or universities may run them. And, you know, here in Connecticut, Mr. Vallis, who is now was the one who was put in Bridgeport when the state took over Bridgeport, which has been reversed by the courts. There's things going on there, but he's still there. He actually ran the Philadelphia school system from 2002 to 2007, I believe, and really implemented the first really aggressive kind of privatizing of public schools where he offered up, I think, 40 schools to outside third parties to run. So he really kind of push that forward. And so we're looking at almost a decade later where we're at in that school system. That's pretty devastating. And similar things are happening around the country. It's happening in New Orleans. Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education, made the comment that the best thing that happened to New Orleans public schools was Hurricane Katrina. Well, they basically have gone in, and I think 70% of the students there will be taught by private charters or charter companies, private nonprofits. But anyways, a third party. So it's confusing about profit, nonprofit, and all that. But there's profit to be made when third parties come in and run
the
school
system. I see
it as
a middle step to getting where they want to go with total private.
Right.
Unfortunately, James, we're running out of time. Is there anywhere that the listeners can go to get more information about what's going on in the public schools and get good information on this?
Well, it's tough because it doesn't get a lot of coverage in the mainstream media and on radio and television. So you don't really get to see a lot of these kind of conversations happen. But certainly I would pay attention to your local community newspapers. They often will be the ones that they'll talk about this more in depth than you'll see on your television news station. So I would say keep an eye on your local community newspapers, get engaged in your local school community, school board meetings, talk with your community teachers. And there are education blogs out there. The Washington Post has an excellent blog. Diane Ravitch blogs quite a bit about this. She was a proponent of this back under George W. Bush and now is an outspoken critic of it. So you can certainly follow her.
And that was Diane Ravitch, R-A-V-I-T-C-H?
Yeah. Jonathan Pelto here in Connecticut blogs about it, and he blogs about this once or twice a day on Malloy and his ed reform bill. Mm-hmm. So if you go to jonathanpelto.com, I believe, but it's called Wait What, I believe. He blogs about it extensively. So that's a local blog here that covers this education debate here in Connecticut.
Great. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I shared this topic with you today because, as I see it, it's all connected. The wealthy power elite, the 1%, if you will, are well-organized and have the ultimate goal of full-spectrum dominance. As the neocon Project for a New American Century stated in the late 1990s and early 2000s, they're geniuses at taking public money and putting it into their private hands. Just look at the bank bailouts and the endless wars we're in. Naomi Klein, in her powerful book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, wrote about how after a disaster, either a natural one or an orchestrated one, the power elites take advantage of people's shock to push through economic or other policies that in normal times people would not tolerate. I believe that 9/11 was one of these orchestrated events, giving huge profits to many corporations and allowing our civil liberties to be trampled on. The privatization of our public education system isn't just happening in education. It's happening in our prisons, the military, our intelligence organizations, homeland security, and healthcare. These privatization schemes are not new. The IMF and the World Bank have been using them on developing countries for a long time. They're currently imposing privatization schemes on the European countries such as Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain. And now the chickens are coming home to roost in the U.S. I also recently learned that the latest educational initiative, the Common Core State Standards, was also started by a few board members for GE and the RAND Corporation. So again, corporately driven for corporate profit. In education, as in all the other aspects of our lives that are being controlled by the power elite, they are very well organized, very powerful, and relentless. And the only way for us to stop them is to educate ourselves, unite, and become active. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.